Headlines. China strongly condemns the trade deal signed between the US and Taiwan, saying the move is in breach of the One China principle. Members of the United Nations elect Iran as a vice president of the upcoming UN General Assembly, despite strong objections by the United States. Also ahead, British Muslims condemn the UK charity regulators' shutting down of the Iran-affiliated Islamic Centre of England. We'll have a report from London. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, China and the US remain on a collision course over the issue of Taiwan. Beijing has now blasted a trade deal Washington and Taipei struck on Thursday. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson says the deal is in breach of the One China principle and shows the US is trying to undermine the principle. The deal was inked under a framework for talks between Washington and the self-ruled island, known as the U.S.-Taiwan Initiative on the 21st Century Trade. China has time and again warned the U.S. against its growing ties with Taiwan, as it views the island as an inseparable part of its territory. Russia says Ukraine's recent drone strike on Moscow amounts to an act of terrorism, adding the only way to deal with terrorists is to destroy them. The remarks were made by Deputy Chairman of Russia's Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev. He said the drones used in Ukraine's strike were not able to damage military facilities or public administration buildings. Medvedev added that Kiev's main goal was to cause damage to and harm Russia's civilian population. He accused the Ukrainian government and its supporters, especially the United States and Europe, of behaving like terrorists. On Tuesday, the Russian capital was targeted by the biggest drone strike since the war with Ukraine began last year. The strike targeted several areas, including a suburban neighborhood where Russia's President Vladimir Putin has an official residence. Ukraine has denied involvement in the attack. Meanwhile, Ukraine says Russia has rained dozens of missiles and drones on the capital Kiev, resulting in the death of three civilians. Videos circulating online show citizens in Kiev taking shelter as air raid sirens wailed across the city. Ukrainian authorities say they were able to down at least 30 projectiles. Russia has stepped up its airstrikes on Ukraine since the start of May. Meanwhile, Moscow says it has repelled three cross-border attacks near the town of Shevakino. The Russian Defense Ministry has pointed the finger at Kiev, accusing it of carrying out terrorist acts to kill Russian civilians. Divisions grow in the EU over the bloc's relentless military support for Ukraine. EU member Hungary favors peace negotiations, and that stance is creating tensions. Our Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes reports.
EU leaders accused the Hungarian government of casting democratic values aside with respect to judicial reforms and press freedom. However, analysts say their real issue is that Budapest is not towing the line with respect to the war in Ukraine. EU affairs ministers met on Tuesday to debate so-called EU values in Hungary. On her way into the meeting, Hungarian Justice Minister Judit Varga slated the European Parliament for criticising her government. Minister Varga says that the European Parliament does not respect EU values, does not respect democracy in Hungary, does not respect rule of law. What do you think?
The European Parliament has full democratic legitimacy to adopt the resolutions in case they see the political need to do so. So that's the only comment I have.
The EU has so far spent 10 billion euro on weapons for Ukraine. EU nation Hungary is against the policy, and that seriously irks Brussels and Washington.
There is no chance to win this war. So therefore, what we should do far more energy invest into to convince everybody that the only solution is ceasefire.
Experts say Prime Minister Orban is correct to suggest the EU is concentrating too much on propelling the Ukraine war.
He definitely has a point, because here in Brussels you hear people saying, okay, it's always about Ukraine, it's Ukraine this, Ukraine that, but we should not forget the Palestinians in Gaza, we should not forget the Syrians, we should not forget the Sudanese.
It's clear the Hungarian government is a major thorn in the side of the EU project at present. However, Eurosceptic parties in other member states are on course to make significant gains in forthcoming elections, helped on by the cost of living crisis. Therefore, the problems might only be starting for the establishment here. Jerome Hughes at the EU Affairs Minister's meeting, Brussels.
Members of the United Nations have elected Iran as a vice president of the 78th UN General Assembly, despite objections by the United States. The permanent representative of Iran in New York has now become one of the five vice presidents from the Asia-Pacific group in the upcoming session of the Assembly. UN members also unanimously voted to appoint Iran's candidate as the rapporteur of the Disarmament and Non-Proliferation Committee of the General Assembly. The decisions come as Washington has been trying to prevent the Iranian mission's selection for the past weeks. Outrage in the wake of the UK's charity regulators shutting down of the Iran-affiliated Islamic Centre of England. Muslims, among them donors who have for years benefited from the services the centre provides, have condemned what they called the Charity Commission's intrusion on the spirit and determination of their community. Saeed Poreza reports.
On a typical evening, they'd be praying inside the magnificent building behind them. But tonight, they're not.
I am disgusted that I have to stand outside of my center in a democratic country. And this just shows how corrupt the UK actually is.
It's heartbreaking that we can't do what we love doing, and it's just praying, making dua, and just celebrating as a family, like a big family.
In late May, the Islamic Center of England, one of Britain's biggest Shia mosques, shut its doors after the UK's charity regulator, the Charity Commission, appointed a non-Muslim interim manager with the power to overrule its current trustees.
What the mosquegoers here are saying, that the mere act of having a non-Muslim decide what they can say or believe in inside their religious institutions is a new type of systemic racism and of Islamophobia on the part of the British state.
Around 20 years ago, they decided that they would define what is good Islam, what is bad Islam. Good Islam is something that the politically, the sort of secular British society and British government feels comfortable, feels that is compatible with their political, social, economical agenda, i.e. people who will follow all the aspects of the British government.
The center has been under investigation by the Charity Commission since a 2020 vigil was held here for U.S.-assassinated Iranian General Qasem Soleimani.
At the height of terrorism in Britain, IRA, when the actually individual died, even in bombing or in prison, they were given all their rights in Catholic Church. Nobody said you should deny the religious right of someone because they've been accused of this or that, or even proven. So why suddenly, when someone is, you know, has passed away, we cannot feel sympathy or complain that they've been unlawfully killed?
Founded in 1995, the Islamic Center of England is funded by Iran and run by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's representative in the UK. The Charity Commission is yet to conclude and publish the findings of its inquiry. Until then, a Muslim congregation without a place of worship. Saeed Poreza, London.
Staying in Europe, where for 5 months France has been consumed by social unrest over a two-year increase in the retirement age, many predict the coming week will be decisive, but few expect France's powerful president to budge. Rami Mazahari has more from Paris.
Teachers and railroad workers led strikes nationwide in France. But the fight against the two-year pension age hike via presidential decree is heading towards what seems like a conclusion. Upset over being bypassed, Parliament is expected to hold a vote on the age increase next week, but it seems like a formality. The conservative-dominated upper house appears certain to back President Emmanuel Macron's latest executive order. Next week, we'll also see the 15th million-person march this year against the age hike, but that may be the last one. Many speculate that the hardline government has successfully ignored saucepan-banging protesters, financially exhausted striking workers, and worn down a nation in seemingly constant battle over right-wing austerity measures.
Qui sont des institutions antidémocratiques.
It's clear that Macron has all the institutions of France's Fifth Republic behind him, which are all anti-democratic institutions, and that he will not stop using them against the will of the majority and against the French people. We don't have any illusions about these institutions anymore, and something is growing in the minds of the French the more that Macron refuses to compromise, that the only thing left is a general strike to shut down the country.
The age increase was alleged to be urgent in order to plug a 10 billion euro gap in a pension system which requires 340 billion euros annually. Creating controversy over a minor 3% deficit in a hugely popular social program has diverted much attention from the increasingly volatile deficit between worker salaries and record prices. Western sanctions against Russia over the almost decade-long unrest in Ukraine continue to backfire, and the strikes include wage increase demands alongside resistance to the pension age decree.
Ben, nous, ce qu'on demande, c'est l'augmentation.
Across all sectors, there are demands for an increase in salaries, which simply can't be ignored any longer. The government hasn't increased the salaries of government workers since last summer, which seems like a lifetime ago in terms of our purchasing power.
Calls for the second general strike in the past 4 years continue to be ignored by the nation's mainstream media, as do protests by the once intensely motivating Yellow Vest group. There continues to be massive public opposition to the second pension age hike in 13 years, but unrest may peak and then start to decline next week. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Turning elsewhere, the U.S. Senate has said yes to a bill that would allow the government to borrow more money.
On this vote, the yeas are 63, the nays are 36. The 60-vote threshold having been achieved, the bill is passed.
The legislation was passed the day after the lower chamber of Congress gave its approval to it. President Joe Biden, who will sign the newly passed bill, praised the Senate's move. He described the bipartisan agreements as a big win for U.S. economy and the American people. The legislation would fend off a first ever U.S. default on its debts, which now stand at $31.5 trillion. The government was forecast to hit its borrowing limit on June the 5th. The Treasury Department had warned that it would be unable to pay all its bills to on that date if Congress failed to act by then. Hundreds of people have poured into the streets in the U.S. state of Florida to protest the new immigration law. Organizers of the rally, dubbed it as a day without immigrants, urged workers and businesses to stay home or stay closed on Thursday. A group of protesters also gathered outside a state Republican representative's office who supports the law. According to the bill ratified by the state's governor, those who employ undocumented immigrants would be penalized. State officials have hailed the bill as the strongest anti-illegal immigration legislation in the country. The new law will take effect from July. U.S. President Joe Biden falls on stage during a graduation ceremony for the Air Force Academy in Colorado. The incident happened after Biden delivered his address to the graduates. The White House later stated that he fell after a sandbag caught his foot while he was shaking hands. Biden is the oldest person ever in the U.S. presidency. His missteps and worsening health have become fodder for political rivals and critics, as he recently announced that he is running for a second term in the 2024 presidential race. The U.S. president's personal doctor, however, has declared him healthy and fit for presidency. An 8-year-old Panamanian girl has died due to medical negligence while in the U.S. border police custody, the second migrant death in the U.S. government custody in the last 2 weeks. An investigation into the death of the minor revealed that her mother had repeatedly called for an ambulance for the girl, who was suffering from heart disease. The child died while her family was held for 9 days at the border police station for deportation. This is while the agency's policy limits the custody to 72 hours. Her death comes a week after a Honduran teenage migrant at a shelter facility in Florida. Elsewhere, Canada's government sends the military to areas affected by unprecedented wildfires. The Canadian Armed Forces have been dispatched to the eastern coastal province of Nova Scotia to provide equipment and personnel to the firefighters struggling with blazes. So far, some 28,000 people have been forced to flee their homes across the country. Canada is now struggling with 200 wildfires burning in 7 of its 10 provinces. Canadians in the east of the country are also sweltering under extreme heat wave. The extreme weather conditions are believed to be caused by global warming. North Korea has denounced the UN chief's condemnation of its recent satellite launch. Pyongyang says it will continue to exercise its sovereign rights, including launching military surveillance satellites. The remarks came just one day after North Korea said it will soon put another military satellite into orbit after its first attempt failed. Antonio Guterres strongly condemned the launch, saying any launch by Pyongyang using ballistic missile technology violated the UN Security Council resolutions. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. The results of the latest studies carried out in Britain show that half of the British people were worried about the sudden increase in the cost of living on a daily basis and cannot afford their living expenses. Studies have also indicated that the unprecedented inflation in England has had a negative impact on the mental health of people who are forced to buy less and cheaper goods, and also fund soaring care charges out of their benefits. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Disabled people are paying a tax on disability by being forced to fund soaring care charges out of their benefits as the cost of living pushes care users into financial crisis. Charities and disabled people's organisations, including MenCap, Scope and MS Society, Inclusion London, Dimensions and Win Visible, said that disabled care users are being pushed into severe financial hardship, with some forced to go without essential home care because they can't afford the fees. Others face up to £20,000 of arrears to their local authority, with some seeing bailiffs called in over care fee debts. Svetlana Kotova, Director of Campaigns at Inclusion London, said, "Disabled people who are entitled to statutory social care are now confronted with an increasingly impossible choice between essential care or covering basic living costs, including energy to heat their homes or to power their essential equipment, such as wheelchairs and ventilators." Svetlana Kotova added, "Thousands of disabled people are pursued for social care debt, including through the courts of law, which they don't have the money to pay. Making disabled people pay for the care that they need is effectively a tax on disability." Claire Glassman, coordinator of Win Visible, a disabled people's organisation for disabled women, warns that care charges are making disabled women more vulnerable to abuse by family, as they're forced to become financially dependent on them. Unlike the National Health Service, social care is not free at the point of need. Councils require social care recipients to contribute towards the home care that they receive in nearly all areas of England, but charges have been rising rapidly in recent years. Regulations are meant to ensure local authorities leave disabled people with a set amount of money to live off once their social care charges have been paid, known as the minimum income guarantee. The government agreed to bring the minimum income guarantee in line with inflation in February after years of freeze. But charities and disabled people's organisations say some local councils are failing to take into account recent hikes in energy bills and rent in their calculations, while others aren't recognising the additional expenses disabled people face, such as accessible transport and specialist food, which have also become more expensive with inflation. The Guardian understands that people with learning disabilities are being given lengthy and complex form assessments by their councils without it being explained what they are or being offered support. Jackie O'Sullivan of learning disability charity MenCap said, "MIG rising with inflation after so many years of staying the same is welcome, but many are shocked to discover that people on meagre benefits are expected to pay for their care too." Sarah Lewis owes her council over £4,000 for getting washed and dressed. Last year, the 59-year-old's charges went from zero to £55 a week. She said the assessment was clearly flawed. It consists of one page with no assessment of income or outgoing costs. Sarah Lewis's multiple disabilities, including fibromyalgia, arthritis and cerebral palsy, means she is unable to work and live solely off disability benefits. With no way to fully pay her care costs, she now has thousands of pounds of arrears and is struggling to pay other bills. She continued by saying, "I have no idea how I'm going to pay the debt. I'm terrified my care will be terminated." The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. A report warned cases of people contemplating suicide as a way out of debt have increased amid soaring living costs. According to Christians Against Poverty, or CAP, People receiving state benefits are also increasingly skipping meals and turning off heating because they do not have enough money to live on. The debt charity, Christians Against Poverty, which offers people financial support and debt advice, said it was shocked by the substantial rise in clients reporting suicidal thoughts in the past year. Half of the respondents to a survey of over 600 clients said that they had considered or attempted suicide as a way out of debt. This was a jump of 14%, up from 36% who expressed these thoughts a year ago. Rachel Gregory from Christians Against Poverty, or CAP, said the people had reached new levels of hopelessness due to rising cost of living. She said, "We've long been aware of the issue of suicide driven by people's problems with debt, but we have been really shocked by the scale of the increase that we have seen recently." Rachel Gregory added, "We are now in a position where one in two people who come to us have considered suicide as a way out of their debt. The speed of that rise has been really substantial because it has been pretty static, around a third, for a significant number of years before that." She said, "We're trying to let people know that advice can help a lot, and we also want to sound the warning that we're seeing this increase in people who just don't have enough money to live on and are having to borrow to pay for essential living costs." According to the charity, the Joseph Rantree Foundation, 9 in 10 of Christians Against Poverty's new clients in 2022 received some of their income from benefits. Social Security payments are currently at their lowest ever level relative to earnings at 13%. The organization reported some 90% of low-income households received universal credit, report going without essentials to make ends meet. This tallies with the people seeking help with rising debt from Christians Against Poverty, CAP. In 2022, the charity helped 9,168 people with their debt problems, and on average, new clients owed a total of £11,240. In one case that Christians Against Poverty CAP supported, James, a machine operator, was laid off during the pandemic by the mailing company he had worked for 7 years. He said, "As an agency worker, I wasn't entitled to any financial support when I lost my job, so everything spiraled out of control." James added, "Universal credit was my only income. I was relying on it to pay my rent, my bills, to buy food. However, I had several county court judgments and debts being deducted from my payments. I thought that they had to leave you with enough to live on, but I was losing half of my benefits every month. It wasn't enough to cover my rent, and I thought I was going to lose my house." James's mother paid for his internet so that he could still search for work online, and he would go round to hers for tea as he couldn't afford food or heating. He started sleeping downstairs on the couch for the fear that bailiffs would turn up with an eviction order. He added, "I didn't go anywhere for 18 months. I was barely surviving." Rising cost of rent has also been pushing Britons into poverty, with new data from Spare Room showing that 81% of renters in the United Kingdom are spending more than 30% of their take-home pay on rent. The flatshare site said over one in three renters are now spending more than half of their salary on rent, meaning that they classify as severely rent burdened. According to CAP's annual client survey of over 600 clients, 54% of people said they had skipped meals at least once in a month, an increase from 47% in the situation in 2021. This rose to 59% of people who were receiving disability benefits, Data showed 51% of people said they had been unable to heat their homes, up from 45% in the previous year. The charity said those based in the northeast of England and London had the highest average peak debt.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdy. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Protests in Europe are continuing unabated. This time, thousands of teachers and healthcare professionals have taken to the streets in the Spanish capital, Madrid, demanding better pay and working conditions. This can be applied to other countries in Europe, like the UK and France. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether European governments have efficient economic game plans when it comes to resolving their citizens' problems, or will they blindly support the Ukraine war, which has been one of the factors that has led to European economic miseries. First, let me introduce our correspondent from Brussels, Jerome Hughes, who joins us to give us the latest on this. Well, Jerome, you have another strike action, and protest, I should say, or combined, perhaps you can tell us, this happening in Spain, and I believe also one in Italy. Give us what you have on this.
That's right, Covey, and many more planned as well, because we have record high employment in the EU, which is a good news story. The problem is there are far too many poor quality jobs, so you have a situation whereby lots of people, millions of people are on the minimum wage. The minimum wage is certainly not keeping up with very high inflation, and workers are sick and tired. Just because you have full employment, it doesn't tell the full story. The situation is that the cost of living crisis continues to be out of control. You have inflation higher in some EU member states than others, and you have a situation whereby people cannot pay their rents, cannot pay their mortgages. Just a few days ago, the European Central Bank celebrated its 25th anniversary, and Christine Lagarde was there cutting an enormous cake. And on social media, she received scathing criticism because people are saying that these people at the top of the tree, earning huge salaries, they're completely out of touch with ordinary people who are struggling to heat their homes at night when it does get colder, even at this time of year, and also struggling to put food on the table. Interest rates keep going up, inflation remains very high, and we have the situation whereby we have the latest figure, €65 billion has been sent to Ukraine from the EU alone, €65 billion.
All right, thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. Jerome Hughes there from Brussels, a correspondent. Thank you for that update. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight now. Clive Menzies, political economy researcher and analyst, joins us from London. And Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, joins us from Brussels. Welcome to you both. Gilbert Doctorow, let me first start with you. We are looking at protests that are happening on a weekly basis at a minimum. Some of the countries that we are seeing the protests occur in frequently are places like France and the UK. Now we're looking at Spain, which is not obviously their first time people coming out to protest involving teachers and healthcare professionals, from what we're looking at. But what is your assessment when you keep hearing and witnessing these strikes that are happening in Europe? In this case in point, we're looking at Spain and also Italy to be the latest.
Well, the strikes are about different issues in different countries. There is a commonality of cost of living crisis across Europe, but that has not resulted in a commonality of strike movements and protest movements. In France, the protests have been enormous, but they were about a local issue, a French issue of raising the pension age. You've just remarked on strikes of teachers and health workers in Spain. That, again, is a local issue that is driven by the local conditions. Here in Belgium, we had strikes this past Monday. I don't know that your journalists were aware of it because they were strictly a local issue, but they brought out four of the largest unions in the country, and all of the public transport in Brussels was greatly disturbed, if not shut down, as a result of strikes. For what purpose? The strikes were about the changeover by one of the largest supermarket chains in Belgium, Delhaize, who are disposing of their assets and franchising out their 100 or plus stores across the country. And this is protested by the labor unions because the new franchisees are going to change the work rules and compensation and so forth. So the whole protest was about what's called social dumping. But the point I want to make is that the commonality of the problem, which comes across the EU from the very poor judgment of the leadership of the EU countries with respect to the war in Ukraine and the imposition of sanctions, which are self-destructive for the economies of Europe, that is not taken up across the board in any of the countries. So the not to mention the fact that the threats and the risks to peace and security and to the survival, indeed, of these countries, if the war expands, as it's on a track to do, that is not discussed. Mm-hmm. We're living in a fool's paradise, and that is terribly regrettable. I see no opposition movements of any kind to the inevitable evolution of this war from a Ukraine-Russia war to a European-wide war.
Okay. Clive Menzies, I'm sure you have a deep analysis on this, but when you take a look at a country like Spain, I have to group that, well, I don't have to, but I want to group that with Italy and France in terms of the debt that they're carrying, and it's quite high. Greece is the number one, but Italy, 147.3% of the GDP, then Portugal, and then Spain, 115.6%, and France, 113.4%. The reason why I'm putting these countries together and ask you, as to the fact that this is not about just the Ukraine war. Prior to this, you had COVID-19, and prior to that, you had the countries that were struggling. And, of course, we can go back to the 2008 financial crisis, where we haven't really looked at the countries recuperating from that economic mess back then.
Indeed. Good evening, Kelly. Undoubtedly, we were predicting at least a decade ago that we were heading for some sort of disaster, and we were pretty public about it in the city and elsewhere from about 2015. And a lot of this is driven by money supply. There is a massive oversupply of money in the major economies, and that there is a price to be paid for that. And we're also seeing the final throes of plunder. In the UK, the amount of money that is being harvested off individuals, groups, sections of society for driving, for all sorts of things. Plunder is full on. We said last year we're heading into crazy times. We're now in those crazy times, and it is all driven by money. But it is actually, we do have a way out of this, and we also have the building blocks already in front of us. But maybe I'll come back to that later.
Okay, yeah, definitely we want to hear what those building blocks are. All right, so Gilbert Doctor, you talked about the Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. I'd like to find out from you if you can tell us whether the EU is actually living almost at the present when it comes to their energy supplies. The reason why I ask that is back in December of 2022, von der Leyen, the European Commission President, said, "We have managed to withstand Russia's energy blackmail with our RE Power EU plan to reduce demand." She talked about 300 billion euros worth of investments. The result is that we are safe for this winter. So that's for the winter of 2022. But when you take a look at what's going to happen for 2023 and then the next winter after that, Europe as a whole does not have enough energy reserves, if I'm correct to say that. And they're kind of go as they plan or plan as they go. I'm not too sure what the phrase is. Are they aware what they're dealing with when they're supporting the Ukraine war as they have been, as to what they're dealing with in terms of maybe coming up short with energy and how disastrous that would be?
Well, even the Financial Times and articles in the last couple of weeks have dealt with this issue and have come up with the findings that, yes, Europe has saved 15 or 20% in its annual consumption of gas, and how wonderful that is. And yet, in 2023 and 2024, they still will be required to import 10, 20, 30%, oh, well, not 30, but 20% of their gas supplies from Russia by one means or another. Still, the issue is not whether they can heat houses. The issue is whether they can maintain industry. Despite the fact that, yes, they covered the needs and the population did not go cold in this past winter, partly thanks to a mild winter, the fact remains that industry began moving out of Europe. This was most notable in Europe's largest manufacturer and exporter of industrial goods, Germany. The Financial Times, and again, is a very useful source because they are not interested in showing crisis. On the contrary, they're interested in showing stability. And they have remarked on how the German Mittelstand, the medium-sized family-owned companies, are moving to Switzerland and to Sweden because of the high price of energy in Germany. Now, the larger companies are moving to the States. Bayer Leverkusen announced maybe 6 months ago that they are disinvesting in Germany and moving production capacity to the States, where energy is cheaper. There are whole sections of industry which cannot maintain a competitive product in the environment that we have now and are likely to continue to have, even if Europe's leaders say they are covering the needs, not at a price that industry can afford. The glass industry is one, metallurgy is another. This all has an impact on jobs and on the population at large. But the single biggest issue is not power right now. The single biggest issue in the cost of living problem and deterioration of living standards is in food. Again, 2 weeks ago, the UK reported that food inflation for the past year has been on average 18%. That is average. In given food categories, whether it's dairy or vegetables or whatever, if it goes up to 50% or even 100%, this is something that the average working man feels every time they go shopping. And it takes out of his pocket an important amount of money that otherwise would go to enjoying life. Here in Belgium, my wife is a member of a women's club of professional women, retired women, but women who have had comfortable lives by their husband's income and by their own income. And they are complaining around the dinner table that they're shocked at the prices here in Belgium, and still more shocked when some of them who have relations in London and go back and forth visit the UK. This is something that wealthy people are complaining about and poor people are suffering from at a great deterioration of the living standards.
Okay. All right, let's go to the building blocks that you talked about, Clive Menzies. Go ahead.
Well, the thing is, before the adoption of money, we operated on the basis of knowing and trusting all those within the community with whom we dealt. Money was a very useful mechanism to deal with people outside the community where you didn't have access to data. There wasn't a means to understand what those needs and capacities of those communities were. However, we're now in the age where companies like Google, Amazon, eBay, Microsoft, Facebook have got huge volumes of data that are analogous to the sort of data that we used to carry about who was buying what, who was friends with who was good at what. All of that information is now being stored. The only difference is it's being monetized. If we open source that big data, then we don't need money. And most of these problems that we see that result from competition would switch into cooperation, and we'd live in a world of miraculous abundance. Now, that sounds like utopia, but if you bear in mind that the current system works in direct contradiction to our interests, what our needs and capacities, what we need to fulfill our capacities to be able to do things, has nothing to do with money. Money has a completely separate valuation that causes conflict and causes wars and competition and all the rest of it. We have the building blocks to change the way we live, and it could happen very quickly because the power of the internet is making transformation at record speed, and more people are looking at this idea of, instead of focusing on money, let's focus on the data. And if you look at Amazon Fresh, you walk in, you walk out, okay, money changes hands at your bank account, but what is most important in all that transaction is the data about people, what they can do, what they need, and we can satisfy everybody's needs. We have more than enough resources in the world to feed, clothe, house everyone more than once, and all we need is a different system, because this one clearly doesn't work and it's breaking. And if we don't think of something different, then more and more people are going to die, more and more people are going to suffer hardship, and the problems that your other guests referred to will just continue.
Sure.
We just need to think differently.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, I think that has actually happened, Gilbert Doctorow, the whole thinking differently process. I think the WEF back a couple years ago talked about this transformation that needs to take place. And, of course, green energy has been something that's been propelled. Well, the U.S. seems to have taken a leading role. But given what has happened with the energy crisis, which stemmed from, in one sense, from the Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, countries are reverting back to the old sources of energy, so it's not having that impact. And based on this particular source that was researched for this program, when it comes to the fact where we talk about protests, it says protests over food and fuel surged in 2022, the biggest were in Europe, which has continued in 2023, and it blamed soaring energy prices, whereas to contrast to a decade ago, it said food prices were to blame. So this transformation has fallen flat, right?
I'm afraid I don't quite follow your question.
Well, the transformation that they've talked about hasn't happened because you have an energy crisis, the thirst for energy, and to go green is not. It seems like the infrastructure is not really in place, but countries' economies need to. Move. The wheels need to be in motion. So they're reverting. They're not really moving away from oil. They're going back to coal countries like China, I could even say. And therefore, this whole green transformation is not happening. I'm trying to relate that to what Clive Menzies said in terms of the new approach that needs to take place.
Well, the green movement has made enormous traction in the last couple of years. And, of course, the attempts to cut gas consumption has been a factor here in the last year in the new enthusiasm of the population at large for placing the electric or heating generating panels on roofs. And the whole public is deeply involved in discussing it at home and with friends. At the same time, I can tell you that here in Belgium and in Germany, I know from colleagues there, that the price of firewood has doubled and tripled in the last year. So not only are we not going back to coal, but people are heating their homes with firewood. Now, you tell me, please, is that progress, or is that a reversion to energy sources that we thought had long been abandoned?
Okay, so, Clive Menzies, the protest that happened in Spain, it was reported to be in the tens of thousands. I believe it was 70,000 to 120,000 altogether. You had maybe less numbers in Italy, but you had some of the biggest that have happened in France, where it was a million months ago. And you have these protests. I think Belgium was in the tens of thousands also, if I'm correct.
Yes.
There. When is the time where you think that, and the fact that Gilbert Doctorow, our guest in Brussels, said that the food problem is really at an elevated state at this point, where people are feeling the pinch of the rising inflation of food. When do you think that threshold is going to pass, where people are going to say enough is enough, and that governments are going to feel threatened in order for them to have to react?
Well, I'd say the die is already cast. From what I see locally and around the world, is more and more people waking up to what the Great Reset and the Green Agenda are all about. The carbon reduction they're talking about is people, and people are awakening to that, and they are making alternative arrangements. And so when does this happen? I felt that the tide turned in 2022. There is a rising recognition of the corruption, the criminality, the outright genocide and greed that is just taking place in plain sight. The fact that it's not reported in the main media doesn't really matter, because in social media it's gaining ground. The truth resonates far more strongly than the lies, which need constant maintenance. So I think we are in the beginning of a major seismic change of the way human society operates. And the Great Reset is analogous to Stalin's five-year plans, the Chinese cultural Great Leap Forward, where they are genocidal plans which never work. And people are aware of that, and they're working locally, creating alternatives for health, food, knowledge, information, all sorts of things. People are beginning to help each other rather than relying on the criminal institutions that are now so blatantly greedy and looking to harvest every cent, dollar, penny, euro that they can get their hands on. So we're in crazy times, but new things are emerging, and that is what news programs like this one ought to be looking at, because that's where the future is, rather than the sort of final death throes of a dying system.
Okay, thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. That's Clive Menzies, political economy researcher and analyst from London. Thank you. And Gilbert Doctorow, thank you so much. Independent international affairs analyst from Brussels. We had Jerome Hughes, a correspondent from Brussels, at the top of the program. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavoy and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakah.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. This great imam was one of the founders of the jurisprudence of the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all. He was one of the founders of the very jurisprudence of the Ahlul Bayt that represented creation, originality, and the progress of intellect. Scholars have reported from Imam al-Jawad a wonderful variety of wisdom and literature regarding noble deeds and conducts that are among the most precious maxims dealing with different educational and moral and ethical issues.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. So, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was really in a time where, not only were the different religious, philosophical ideas coming into the Muslim world, but at the same time we find that there was an influx of wealth and also a influx of people as the Muslim lands under the Abbasid Empire continued to grow. We find that different people with different cultures, with different backgrounds came into the fold of Islam. And as many of you are aware, when there are two different cultures that are face-to-face with one another, sometimes misunderstandings occur. Now, when talking about these issues, these social issues with Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, one of the companions spoke about this, how certain misunderstandings come about because of these